doesn't go well, and Jerry is somewhat forced to finally take retirement head on. The end.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
Anything you might tell me about her? Could you describe her?
She must be... She must be different now. She was so pretty. I miss her so much.
Hello, everybody, and look at that. Aaron's got a nice little coaster for us. The apple one. Was that made for us? I can't remember.
A fan made this for us. A little coaster that has an apple with a bite out of it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what he's saying about us. I'm not sure what they're saying.
No, don't know what he's saying either. But anyway, welcome to Recotopia. This is episode 128. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Howdy ho, pledgerinos.
Yes, absolutely. And yes, today's big recommend is The Pledge from 2001. Very interested to hear what you guys think of this movie because it is bleak. It's bleak as hell, guys. Want to welcome chat who have come out here and are watching us talk about movies on a Tuesday. And hey, happy birthday, History Lover. I saw that earlier. You came and joined us on your birthday. Thank you so much for that. I guess I'll start us off with the small recommends.
Do it.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I was just looking for something short that I could watch on a streamer for the past week, and I ran across a movie that I'd heard of many times, but had never seen, called Brief Encounter from 1945. And this is one of David Lean's first movies. I can't remember. The IMDb puts another one underneath this. But when you look at the release dates, this one came out first. So I don't know which one came out first. Anyway, Brief Encounter is a movie that I would never have expected to come out of 1945. Although there are limitations to what they can do with this subject matter. But it concerns a woman who is played by Celia Johnson, who she's married, but she goes out every Thursday to do shopping and watch movies and get a new book and all this other stuff. And she happens to run into another married person played by Trevor Howard. And they start up a friendship that definitely is a little bit more than what they want it to be, what they want to classify it as at first. It's definitely a romantic type of thing, or it could become a romantic type of thing. And it's basically being told through Celia Johnson's narration throughout. She has come home. This is basically the end of the story, is at the beginning of it. She comes home and she's in this kind of like boring marriage with her husband. Her husband's not a bad guy, just not like as exciting as this new guy is that she's seeing. And she's basically just telling this story as if in a dream, how she met this person and how there was all these different things that she wanted to do with this person and everything. And so the whole movie is, the conflict is, you know, what's going to happen? Are they actually going to consummate this thing? 1945, they're probably not going to, you know that because of the Hays Code, but seeing them interact and seeing how much they come alive when they are together and everything is exciting. But you also have this thing in the back of your mind. They're married. I don't know if they're going to be able to go through with this, but it's a great, great movie. It's only an hour and 20 minutes. So
I need to check this one out. I've got it on my list now, after you recommending it. But yeah, I have not seen this one, but I'm excited to check it out at some point.
Yeah.
My first small recommend is Alien Romulus. Just came out. Ooh. The new Alien movie. And, you know, I enjoy the Alien movies for what they are. I'm not necessarily a horror movie person, but the Alien movies, kind of bridge horror and sci-fi in a way that the world building kind of gets me interested. And certainly the immense amount of world building that this franchise has done. There are so many canonical movies now that, you know, it makes it interesting to kind of see where we're going. Now, Alien Romulus takes place, I believe, between the first two. So after Alien and before Alien dollar sign. As it were. So yeah, and I think it just does all the things an alien movie is supposed to do. I don't think it's like, you know, gonna blow anybody away, but it just feels like the creature work is really interesting and cool. The performances are great. The dread, you know, kind of that like tension and dread is there throughout. It does some, you know, it's kind of an interesting you know, take on the horror, you know, like the horror, you know, final girl kind of stuff, you know, and I really enjoyed it. Had a good time. Kelly Spaney, I think, is really, really good in it. And David Johnson, I believe is his name, is also really good. I only know him from Rye Lane, which I don't know if you saw Rye Lane last year, but he was really good in that. And then I think he's been in Industry, the TV show Industry as well, that I've seen him there. But he is it's, you know, right from the beginning, so I'm not spoiling anything, but he's the synthetic in this one. And there's always these beautiful themes of, you know, what life is valuable. Is synthetic, a valuable life? Is it, you know, different than us? How is it different than us? Are we their gods? You know, like that whole thing is always interesting when the alien movies explore it. And this one is kind of about family. And she considers this synthetic her brother. You know, they grew up together. And so it deals with a lot of that kind of stuff. Anyways, I had a good time and it kept my brain going. And I was thinking about it afterwards. So, yeah.
Yeah, this was something that I wanted to see over the weekend, but I didn't get a chance to. I'm eventually going to watch it, though. It was funny because we came out with that Alien franchise video on CinemaSins and everything. And the idea was we're gonna put them all in the order that they came out, the movies came out,
right,
and everything.
Yes.
That was where, but there was this discussion briefly as to whether we should do it chronologically by the Alien timeline.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrote what I thought was the Alien timeline, and I was apparently very wrong because I thought that the aliens were made well after, I was trying to think of I can't remember what it was, but I put AVP somewhere that it wasn't supposed to be because AVP is modern day. So I just thought it came after, I think I put it after the other ones, but I forgot that they're modern day, but yet the aliens shouldn't be around yet. I don't know. I didn't really look terribly into it, but I was like, people are putting AVP way up here somewhere in the timeline, and I don't know. That was kind of a weird thing to go through. Anyway, I definitely need to see this.
Yeah.
The other one that I watched over the past week that I caught up to, I'd never seen this before. 2001 was a weird year for me movie watching wise because I quit the movie theater in 2001, and then I had a long stretch till about 2002 where I got back into it and everything. So 2001, I didn't watch a lot of the major releases when they came out, and one of those was Legally Blonde. And this movie's dumb, okay? Don't get me. I don't want to. You know, look, this movie is dumb. But Reese Witherspoon is so, so, so fun in this movie. This is kind of like taking her character from Election. And what was the other one that I thought she was like in this? Oh, she was like Alicia Silverstone in Clueless.
Mm-hmm.
See, like, sure. Combine those two characters into this movie. And she's just, I miss this Reese Witherspoon. I know that she, of course, has to go on and move on from this type of stuff as she gets older, but I just kind of miss this kind of Reese Witherspoon because she's so awesome in this. But yeah, the story is dumb. She is dating a man, dating this guy who's going to go to Harvard Law School, who dumps her because she isn't the type of stock that his family would approve of. So she devises a scheme basically to get into Harvard Law School with him, essentially, and try to win him back. And so she studies really hard, but ultimately the Harvard Law School brass decide to let her in because she's kind of hot. That's basically what it comes down to. And then she comes in and she, of course, is immediately shunned by all the other students and everything. And she has to figure out a way to really make her mark, because she's not good in her studies or anything. Meanwhile, she has to deal with the evil Selma Blair, who's the girlfriend now of her former boyfriend. And then she goes under the tutelage of a professor played by Victor Garber. And they end up on this case where Allie Larder is going up for murder. And it's one of those, like, Slumdog Millionaire had not existed yet, but this is a Slumdog Millionaire type of movie, because everything that happens in it is, like, because she knows so much about little things about the case that nobody else would. And so, anyway, very interested to see how this carries over into Legally Blonde 2 whenever I finally watch that movie as well. Anyway, I thought this was a lot of fun, even though it's complete nonsense and stupid.
I believe you mean Legally Blonde 2 Red, White, and Blonde. I believe
yes,
it's the full.
Yes, I do mean that. I need to put respect back in that name.
That's right. I actually really like this movie. It's kind of one of those, I kind of put it in the same category, like, for my feelings, as like The House Bunny. Which is like this, mm-hmm. this silly, dumb, like even probably a little bit problematic, older movie that's just really fun. And mm-hmm. and so much of it has to do with the charisma of the leads. And you're right. I do. Reese Witherspoon is so great in this, you know, kind of thing. And
yeah.
I actually have a soft spot in my heart for this movie as well.
Yeah.
My other small recommend is the movie Batman. But not Batman you're thinking of. Recently went back and watched this, and there is something about the silliness of movies that knew they were silly in the 60s, even maybe even later 50s. We get it again with... parody movies kind of have this vibe too, where it's just like, we know what we are. Mm-hmm. We're just dumb and silly, and we're going to embrace it and have a good time with it. And it's a movie that, if you're willing to vibe with it, I think is really, really fun. I found myself mm-hmm. laughing a lot at the jokes, the subtle innuendos, the different things that they're doing. Of course, one of the most famous scenes is where Batman runs around with a bomb trying to figure out where to dispose of it. And he runs into a nun, so he turns around, and he runs into a person with a baby carriage, so he turns around, and there's somebody, you know, with a dog, and like, he just can't dispose of this bomb. It's just dumb. But it's fun. And I was surprised at how much fun I had with this movie. I will say, if you're looking at it for like an exploration of the Batman TV show with the different, because all the villains are in this. Is it Cesar Romero that's the Joker, and you've got Catwoman, you've got Penguin and Riddler from the TV show. But they're not given a lot to do. They're almost all just cameos, honestly. So you're not going to get a lot of substance here. I had a good time. I smiled all the way through it. So I thought I'd throw it out as a recommend.
I have amazingly never watched this movie, and I don't know why. But I definitely need to put it on the list because I would definitely like to see this. I saw this TV show a handful of mm-hmm. times, and I know a lot of people who love that TV series mm-hmm. as well. So, yeah, I need to get around to this.
Yeah, it's fun.
So, eventually. Well, enough of that merriment and whatever. Let's get on to our big recommend, which is The Pledge from 2001, directed by Sean Penn, starring Jack Nicholson. And here we go.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so... big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
The movie begins with our main character, Jerry Black, played by Jack Nicholson, mumbling to himself. Is this the beginning or the end? Yes, it is. We then move on to snowy Nevada, where we see a less mumbly Jerry fishing on a frozen lake, followed by a customary long drive through the opening credit sequence, taking us to Reno and Jerry's police precinct, where we see him cleaning out his desk for retirement. We see him look outside and see a person with a walker as he contemplates his old age. Then there's some bad Photoshop of his various military service and police accomplishments. Apparently one of those Photoshops is the picture from The Shining, by the way. The movie is about to do a back and forth between Jack's surprise retirement party at a restaurant called the Luau and a teenage boy who gets stuck jet skiing. The teenager sees a Native American named Toby J. Wadna, played by Benicio Del Toro, running away from something and getting into his red truck. The boy ends up stumbling on a terrible discovery, a little girl named Jenny Larson who has been raped and murdered. The boy reports what he sees, and news gets to the retirement party. This is going to be Stan's case. Stan is here, is played here by Aaron Eckhart. But Jerry says he has, 6 hours and a year and a half left to help with his case. It's here the movie plants the seed that most cops and detectives kind of suck at their jobs and aren't equipped to solve cases like this, which means an old schooler like Jerry must do everything in his power to solve this one. After looking at the crime scene, Jerry ends up being the one who has to deliver the bad news to the murdered girl's parents, played by Patricia Clarkson and Michael O'Keefe. The distraught Mrs. Larson gives us a little background about Jenny. On Wednesday, she spends time getting music lessons from her grandmother. Mr. Larson wants to see his daughter, but Jerry knows this wouldn't make anything better because he and the other detectives barely dared to look themselves. Mrs. Larson makes Jerry promise to find the killer, which is probably against his every instinct as a cop, but they didn't call this movie The Pledge for nothing. While Jerry does more work at the crime scene, he's informed that they found Toby, the man the teenager saw running to his truck just before he stumbled on the crime scene. Toby has a record, including statutory rape, but nothing that really stands out as someone who commits a violent crime. This doesn't bother Stan, who is determined to get a confession out of the man, who also appears to have an intellectual disability. Through extremely dubious tactics that return answers that definitely don't add up, he gets the confession. Upon Toby's arrest, the cop tasked to take him to jail allows his weapon to be taken, and Toby threatens the cop before taking his own life. Jerry is about to go to Baja with the airline ticket the force got him for his retirement, but something doesn't sit right with him about the case and he doesn't take the plane. He ends up going back to town and talking to Jenny's grandmother, played by Vanessa Redgrave. We find out a little bit more about the day. Jenny never got on the bus or went to school that day, so Grandma assumes she just went home. Normally, Jenny would take her piano lessons and afterwards she'd go to the candy store downstairs. Jerry then talks to Jenny's friend Becky, who leads him to a drawing Jenny made depicting a giant giving her porcupines. Jerry believes the giant is the killer and that the car in the drawing is a black station wagon. It's a big stretch, and he even tries to get Stan to reopen the case. Stan allows Jerry to at least look into the records of similar past crimes. He finds a couple of hits. In one town, he runs into a cop, played by future Saw alum Costas Mandalore, who uses the station as a Planet Fitness. The case here was never solved and is still technically open, but he takes advantage of this cop's terrible professionalism to steal evidence. He then goes to a retirement home where he runs into a janitor Jim Alstad, played by Mickey Rourke, whose daughter went missing 3 years ago. He is now prepared to take evidence to Stan and his old boss Eric, played by Sam Shepard, to reopen the case. It doesn't go well, and Jerry is somewhat forced to finally take retirement head on. The end!
Uh-huh.
Well, not so fast. Jerry goes for some prime fishing in a place called Sugarbush and rents a place by the lake that is a triangulated spot between the murders he's investigating. He even makes an offer to a gas station owner, played by Harry Dean Stanton, to buy his business/home, which after a couple of rejections is fairly quickly accepted. Jerry can now see who comes in and goes in and out of the town, looking for a black station wagon. Jerry visits a diner/bar where he meets bartender Lori, played by Sean Penn's then wife Robin Wright, that he will eventually end up in a relationship with. After that, he meets with a psychologist played by Helen Mirren, who really isn't all that helpful, except she might remind him that he needs to get laid once in a while. She does impart a little bit of wisdom. Jenny appears to trust the man in the photo, and the time intervals of the murder suggest that he will kill again very soon. After watching an innocuous fishing program that suggests very innocuously that the best bet in landing a big fish is using live bait, we move on to the diner/bar again, where Jerry meets Lori's daughter, Chrissy, who has all the same characteristics as the murdered girls. Jerry asks Lori if she knows any place where he can buy furniture around here, and he ends up asking her to join him. While at a flea market, Chrissy goes missing briefly, but returns with a boot cleaner fashioned like a porcupine. Jerry goes on to visit the person who makes these things, Helen, played by Lois Smith, who tells him about her son Gary, played by Tom Noonan of Manhunter fame, who is a preacher and just happens to drive a black station wagon. Gary will now play the prime suspect in Jerry's mind for quite some time. Gary later even creepily approaches Chrissy with an offer to attend his church. This has to be the guy, right? One night, Jerry gets a knock on his door. Lori shows up with bruises on her face from her ex. He asks she and her daughter to stay at the house and stay away from her ex. Eventually, a romance begins. He loves reading to her daughter and watching after her, and Lori falls for him. There's kind of a dual thing going on here afterwards. Jerry builds a swing set close to the road, kind of already beginning this idea about live bait. But at the same time, it does appear that he cares for Lori and his daughter and her daughter very much. He just might care about the case even more. At some point, while Jerry is out fishing and returns to find out that, oh no, Chrissy went to church with Gary, this leads to a mad dash to the church, complete with a herd of cows blocking his way before he destroys a bunch of private property when he makes a shortcut for himself. Jerry opens the door to find out, oh no, the horror, she's bloody, she's dead, the creepy Francis Dollarhide from Manhunter is killed again. Wait, it's just a regular church service, and the kindly Gary Jackson welcomes him in. Enter the wizard, a man who drives a black station wagon and has a porcupine ornament hanging on his rearview mirror. Chrissy, now highly attuned to welcoming strangers because the last two have been okay, greets the man who gives her some porcupine-shaped candies. She shows Jerry the candies, informs him that the wizard wants to meet her at a picnic ground, and now Jerry puts the wheels in motion to do something that is quite fucked up. He's gonna let her do it, and be sure not to tell Mom. Jerry then somehow gets Stan and a whole team of watchers and snipers out to the area where the meet is to take place. Chrissy shows up and sits at a table. The wizard is running late. As an aside, we are given a bit of information that his name is Oliver and he worked at the candy shop below Jenny Larson's grandma's house. Eventually, Stan calls off the stakeout. He tells Jerry he's going to have to tell Lori about this too. Jerry seems so singularly focused that he doesn't seem to recognize the consequences of that, and he stays behind to continue watching. Lori comes out to pick her daughter up, yells at, and calls it quits with Jerry. She thinks the entire relationship was a lie. Jerry's stunned. He knows the killer is coming, but he's not. He's about to get hit by a huge Mack truck. Jerry was right about who the killer was, but no one will ever know. Stan and the crew of cops drive past the wreck and lament how sad Jerry has become. We now return to the beginning of the movie with Jerry in front of the closed gas station, mumbling to himself and visibly shaking that he was right, but with no way of ever knowing. Aaron, what did you think of this movie?
Oh, Sean Penn, you silly guy. you know, Chris, I didn't like this movie. I think I'll start with that and then I'll go to some good things. Because there's certainly some things that I did enjoy about this movie. But I think Sean Penn has a weird relationship to wanting to. So you like, you know, the old school way you would potty train a dog, like if they did something in the house, you'd shove their nose in it and, you know, make sure they knew what the mistake was. Like, this is Sean Penn with these kind of he wants us to really, like, here is a brutal picture of, you know, a bloodied little girl. Here is, you know, yeah. And even with the ending of the movie, you know, he wants us to feel the you know, the tragedy or irony or whatever of, you know, this policeman. So I think a lot of it has to do with his instincts don't align with kind of what I want my entertainment, you know, to be. It feels to me as if he wants to remove the joy or, you know, the positive things, whereas I like to emphasize those. Like, I like those things to kind of come forward. So that's a me thing, you know, and a reason I'm not necessarily going to vibe with this movie. I also think the Aaron Eckhart character is really over the top. The moment he turns to the camera after he gets the confession and he like gives like a full like sports like celebration to the camera where it's like, yeah, you know, or whatever. I'm just like, okay, yeah, we get it. This is an overconfident jerk face, cocky boy you know, kind of thing. So he was a little much for me. Other than him, I thought all the performances were great. I thought Jack Nicholson was great. I thought everybody else who, you know, entered in. I thought, you know, Benicio del Toro's just, you know, hanging out, doing interesting stuff. Helen Mirren pops in and, you know, just for a little bit and is doing well. And Robin Wright in there as well. Were they married at this time? I know that they
were, or I mean, it may not have been when the movie came out, but they were married when the filming occurred, I believe.
Yeah.
Because she was still using Robin Wright pen, I believe, on her credits.
Yeah, I think so too. And I thought she was great. And there's actually an interesting structure thing that I think maybe a different director, I might have really locked into this movie. I like the story turn it takes at the end is one you don't necessarily see coming. And there is a way, I guess maybe I have a question for you. Maybe we make this a little bit of a conversation because I'm not sure what we're supposed to feel about this. Are we supposed to like Nicholson's character, and are we supposed to feel bad that he is now, you know, kind of mumbling because, you know, the bad guy got in a wreck? Or are we supposed to feel like he deserves this? Like that his obsession led to this result, and that this is actually, you know, kind of consequences to his obsession that wasn't his obsession, you know, to have, other than the pledge that we made. And I'm not sure which the movie really comes down on. What's your feeling on that?
Yeah, I don't think the movie has a clear answer on this, by the way. There may be something in here where it's like you're supposed to interpret this a way, in a certain way, and however you interpret it, that's the right way to do it, you know. Because you're right, this is one of those things where they've made this whole interaction at the end so complex that they've actually eaten themselves a little bit on it. They you know, it's one of those things where it's like he does one of the most unforgivable things that you can do to try to nab this killer. And at the same time, you know, you're supposed to go, well, at any cost, right? We got to make sure that this guy never kills again and all that. But like, there are ways to do this that are not that, you know, that he sort of forgets. And I think, I guess there might be something to the whole, you know, the fact that he doesn't have the support with him. The support that's supposed to be with him is, you know, there are a bunch of bad cops who aren't supposed to be in this job. I thought that was a good sort of, you know, exploration of that culture. There are a lot of people who should not be cops. And that's basically what I feel like the whole theme of this is. And because nobody is a good cop, somebody has to step up. And that's why he enters in this. Now, again, I don't know what the movie is focusing on here. I don't know where it's ultimately saying this is something that you need to do because this happens, or something, you know, something that's in that area. I think it's sort of like you kind of are eating your own plot a little bit here when you make it this complex, where not only are you making it where he's doing something unforgivable to solve this case, but you're also putting it in a situation where he'll never be right. No one will ever understand and even if he is, though, he still did something like incredibly wrong to get to that point. Maybe nobody is fit for to be in this world is maybe the only thing that I can think of by the end of it. Even somebody like him who's apparently has all the professionalism in the world until he retires. And so, like, maybe that's what it is. I would not put it beyond Sean Penn to say this is a world where we shouldn't even have to be talking about this. Nobody is good enough to be in this job, because what are you supposed to do? If you don't do what Jack does in this movie, what are you supposed to do? So like, I wouldn't put it beyond him to say that's what the theme of this movie is. Nobody is a good guy.
Yeah. And that was part of my cognitive dissonance, was I got to the end and I was like, oh, it's almost as if, because you're right, because he makes the decision to use the girl as bait, and then it's just like, I'm out. Like, I mean, how How do you do that? How do you convince the police force to come along with you as you're using it?
Yeah, that didn't get that either, by the way.
A child is bait for a possible serial killer. Now, you could argue that the police force didn't think there was anything to it to begin with so that they, you know, wouldn't care. But I disagree. But, you know, there's so to start to think, oh, wait, was the whole movie, was he bad the whole movie? Like, and when I say bad, I mean just like a poor cop, like, you know, not able to do his job well the whole movie. Like, did he, because we know he missed the plane on purpose so he could try to reopen this case even after he retired. Did he also, like, purposefully befriend this family to use the girl as bait? Like, are we supposed to think that that's a possibility? Like, in the, it almost feels like in the original script that he was just as much of a problematic cop as everybody else. And then in the finished product, because it's Nicholson, or because, you know, this, you know, they wanted a more likable, you know, hero, or not hero, but protagonist, that the first act feels like we're supposed to respect this guy, but then the rest of the movie doesn't back that up. And so I wonder if there was some, I wonder if the full script was even darker in some way, but I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, and that was another thing that I couldn't quite decide on, whether or not he goes ahead and goes through this relationship because he wants to do this thing. I get the sense that he does want to be in this relationship because of the way he flirts with Robin Wright in this movie and everything, but it also becomes like a dual opportunity, because there's a lot of like coincidences and things like that that he keeps running across in this whole thing. It's almost parody at some points where, you know, oh, the girl went missing at the flea market, and oh, she just happens to run into somebody that sells porcupine boot cleaners, even though that's a huge red herring by the end of it. But it's just one of those type of things where he just keeps running into things that whatever. But yeah, when we look at it, when we look at this movie this way, it just, it doesn't hold up, right? But why do I like this movie so much? I don't know. It's one of those things. I think it's one of those things where I love the fact that they went so dark with it. I love the fact that that this person isn't going to be proved right in the end, because not everything is going to be happy ending, and not everything is going to work out your way, even if you think you've done all the right things. And I think in a situation like this, where it's almost saying the end justifies the means, and I am not sure if that's where it's going. Like I said, we don't know where the focus is on this movie. There's something to it. There's something to the end of this where you're just like, man, like nothing worked out, and that's terrible. I feel horrible inside, but that's so different from what I feel on most of these movies. So like I feel like I've watched something pretty good by the end of it. But yeah, there's so many other things in it that if you go by what makes sense in this movie, you're not gonna like it at all. It's gonna be one of those type of movies. So
you know, maybe the message is that the log truck from Final Destination 2 was the hero we all need. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's
absolutely
that's the end of the day. No.
Yeah, well, and I guess, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened if he wasn't involved at all. But to think that maybe this wreck would have happened if none of the other events had happened. But he's on his way to see a girl that would not probably, he probably wouldn't be going to see her if it wasn't for Jack Nicholson and everything. So it would have been kind of fun to see if we could extrapolate that he would have died anyway or whatever. But you can go a whole bunch of ways on this. Like, what if he didn't do any of this and then the killer dies and he's still looking for the killer afterwards? You know, that's another one that you could if he's still looking for him afterwards. I guess he's still looking for him after this, because he knows that he's out there.
I think the insinuation is that he's just lost his mind at this point. The obsession over this pledge has destroyed him. He's just drinking alcohol and you know, mumbling to himself. So yeah, I think that's the insinuation. I think there is definitely some sort of message about obsession here, right? Because I think if nothing else, we see how obsession can turn a human being into a monster. And what could be interesting, again, if if I felt like the movie made more of these parallels, is there's an interesting parallel between him and the serial killer, right? Like, obsession, you know, single-focusedness leads you to some terrible, dark places. And for, you know, for the cop, that's using a little girl you love as bait for a serial killer. But I think that's purposeful. I think that's his obsession at play there. And even during that final moment where he's like, there's not enough people here, and he's running across the river and he's doing all these things, that's terrible, you know, police work too. Like, that's not, you know, mm-hmm. So I think we're definitely supposed to believe that this case has already started to destroy this person. So when Aaron Eckhart talks about, you know, it's sad or whatever, he's kind of right. We don't want him to be right because he's a jerk face, but he's kind of right, you know, that the obsession has, you know, tainted him in some ways, mm-hmm. even though nobody in the movie knows he was on the right track. You know what I mean? Like, so I agree with you that there is something laudable about, you know, doing something different, taking a big swing, you know. And like I said, I like that structure. I like the way the movie, what it decides to do at the end, I think is really interesting and something, you know, you can talk about afterwards and think about afterwards. But yeah, I just think there's so much inconsistency. And mostly, again, for me, it's a worldview thing. Like, the movie's nihilistic worldview, it just, it's harder for me to vibe with. Than a lot of things. But, you know, I liked Fight Club, but I think that had some more interesting things to say about nihilism than maybe this does, or at least maybe more clear things. And maybe as I think about it more, I'll you know, kind of pick out, you know, other little details that I hadn't thought about, but because movies can grow like that. But yeah, it's a big swing, and I always love a big swing. And I think I certainly don't begrudge you or anyone else for really digging this movie, because it's interesting for sure.
No, I knew this one would be polarizing to mostly negative when I picked it, because it's one of those type of things. It's like, we put it out there because this was a movie that I found interesting that I watched, and mm-hmm. and now I'm recommending it to everybody. Yeah. And that's way I've always felt about this podcast, by the way. Like, not picking stuff that's always a banger, although we do our bangers mm-hmm. a lot. But, like, I like picking these ones here that have, like, a 6 point something on mm-hmm. the IMDb, or, like, something that's not universally beloved, because that's easy to talk about. It's easy to go in and talk about how great Singing in the Rain is, you know. But it's not easy to take a movie that's, like, got this many mm-hmm. problems with it and tell you, I really love this. I want other people to watch it. So that's basically what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately what I came out of this movie with on this new viewing is, Penn really wants to show you that I don't think anybody is equipped to handle this world. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering too, like, maybe, you know, maybe he had his daughter by this time or whatever, because this comes out, and I hope I'm not messing up a super secret double feature, but he's in Mystic River a couple of years later, another one about a daughter dying and everything. That's where he won his Oscar. And so, like, I, you know, I wonder if it's one of those type of things where, like, you start thinking, you know, you take a child into this world and you're just like, man, I don't know what I would do if this happened or whatever. And who are we putting this in the hands of? People who probably can't sympathize with you, probably people who can't, who aren't up to the job. And it's comical how many cops in this movie don't do their job correctly. You can count them all, mm-hmm. like every single one of them. The cop that is the first on the scene leaves a pen in the crime scene. He doesn't want to go tell the parents about this. This is just not something he does. The guy who takes Benicio del Toro is like shaky, can't really, doesn't know what he's doing, and he loses his gun. The guy who's, you know, doing workouts in the precinct.
Yeah, this kind of stuff never bothers me. Bothers other people. I can look at this stuff all day.
Yeah, and then there's almost something Cormac McCarthyan about the Jack Nicholson character here, because he's it's almost shown as he's a dying breed. He's somebody who used to know all the things that you're supposed to do in this. And then even he slips up at the end. And so, like, kind of that, if there were, I think if there were anything we talked out here today mm-hmm. that would be the focus of this movie, even though I don't know if it does have a focus, is that in this world, there's nobody you can rely on in this situation. Right. There's nothing that's going to bring your daughter back, unfortunately. Right. And even if you do find the killer, it's not going to help you out in the end. Patricia Clarkson only shows up one more time in this movie. She's the main reason why this movie's called The Pledge. And the only reason she shows up is kind of this whole thing where he's like, well, I'm in this town and I'm seeing people from the other town show up in this town, so maybe I'll see the killer too. That's the only reason she shows up later on in the movie. But that's the thing that I want to come, that's one of the thing that I think I end up coming out with. It's a worldview that, you know, it's not sunny and it's not what you would want if something like this were to happen to you. But that's what we're dealing with, mm-hmm. and that's where I think Sean Penn is coming.
Yeah, I agree. And I do mm-hmm. think there is, if nothing else, a severe consistency in its portrayal of law enforcement as ill-equipped mm-hmm. to, you know, really handle these kind of things. And that has to be intentional. Like you said, there's so much of it. It has to be an intentional theme and part of, you know, this script. So in this story. So, I agree.
All right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
So just like you, I like to save money, and that's why when Mint Mobile came over to our little corner of the internet, I started to pay attention. And let me tell you, something interesting happened. I realized that I think I have an unhealthy relationship with my existing provider. I had to do this thing where it's like, should I try something new? No, I've been with this provider for so long. And then I got to looking at my bill and I thought, do I really want to keep spending this much money when it appears that Mint Mobile can do the exact same for $15 a month? And that's when I started to click around and find out. To get started, I did just what you can do. Go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. And then right there is where I saw the 3-month plans that were like $15 a month. And that includes the unlimited plan. All of the plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text, and they deliver all that on the nation's largest 5G network, which is great. Even better, you can use your own phone number. And I'm kind of, you know, connected emotionally to my phone number. Another thing I probably should dig into in therapy. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. There is a $45 upfront payment required that's equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. And additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Okay, so, you mentioned Mystic River. Chats mentioned stuff like Gone Baby Gone, which crossed my mind, certainly. You know, these kind of police conundrum kind of things. But the movie, tonally, while I was watching this, that just felt like this is a very tonally similar movie that has a very different ending. And we do have a hero, so to speak, in the movie, even though it's not a joyful ending all the way. It's totally different. And that movie is Clint Eastwood's Changeling. So another person who is convinced that the police have it wrong and is mm-hmm. accused of losing their mind and being obsessed over this thing when everybody around them is saying, you know, you're wrong. The police got it. In this case, it's a returned child. Her, you know, child is returned to her. And she is convinced it's not her child for one reason. This child is circumcised. Her child was not circumcised. Seems like a pretty big piece of proof there. But who knows? Maybe the kidnapper circumcised the child while they were in there.
Anyways,
very similar tonally with that feeling of, you know, person who is being accused of losing their mind because the police are inadequate to do their job. Like I said, it does have a little bit of a different ending, but again, not a completely happy ending. So that, you know, tonally it kind of feels similar, but I enjoyed this movie much more. I think Angelina Jolie is incredible in it. And you know, Eastwood, mm-hmm. for all his hits and misses, he knows how to tell a story. And I think this is a really, really well done movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen this since it came out, but it's great. It's funny because we did The Changeling a year or two ago, the George C. Scott horror movie. And then we had to like differentiate these movies and everything. But yeah, I totally agree with this choice. I think this is a great one. By the way, there were some joke ideas for Super Secret Double Feature. And Josh says, he goes, airplane. And then he goes, I was close. And I was like, Josh, you're only close if Changeling has an exclamation.
That's right.
At the end. That's the only way you're close. All right. Next week's homework. It's Aaron's turn. So tell us what we're going to watch next week.
One of my favorite movies of all time. Just after Chris got saying, that's not what the show's about. I'm going to go with a banger, in my opinion. Gattaca. Let's talk about Gattaca.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. So we're going to have an easy time with this one when it comes down to it. So yeah, this is the reason why Maya Hawke exists, by the way. this movie. No, I love Gattaca very much, and I think it does fit this format, because very few people have seen Gattaca, I believe. Not a huge hit when it came out. It has gotten a following, but I don't hear too many people talk about it, even though it had a brand new 4K steelbook that came out recently, which I will be glad to finally watch when this comes around. So definitely want to watch this in the new format. But this movie is really great. This is a guy, Andrew Niccol, who he started off like he was going to be like huge, because he wrote The Truman Show and he did this, and like, and then it kind of fell off a little bit. He's done some things here and there that you might have liked, but like this, there was a huge rise for this guy when Gattaca and Truman Show and everything came out. So yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I haven't seen Gattaca in quite a while.
Yeah.
And this introduced us all to Jude Law too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
For most people, anyway.
Yeah, yeah, it's one of those that it seems to be of the ones I go back to from that era that if I introduce people to it, they're like, oh my goodness, how did I not know this movie existed? In fact, it's one of my son's favorite movies of all time after I introduced him to it. So like, I think it really holds up and is prescient in a lot of ways with a lot of the technology and stuff that it's doing. So yeah.
Yeah. All right, looking forward to that. Looks like we have some time for some questions.
Question. I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
What is the scariest movie you saw at too young an age?
Too young an age. I didn't see a lot of scary movies when I was young. My mom introduced me to some Hitchcock movies, so those are probably the answer, but I decided to go with The Green Inferno, and I saw it at age 38, and I was still too young.
Still too young for The Green Inferno. I think I was roughly the same age when I saw Green Inferno, and I don't think you're of any age to enjoy that movie. That's for sure. That's one of the sickest movies I've seen in a while, and you know, it's probably not even close to the sickest of all time. Like, if you ask horror movie aficionados, you know, they're gonna give you about 500 that are more gross than this. So I don't feel like I was super scared of this, but I saw Pet Sematary really early, and it shouldn't have been at my age. I just thought it was weird that in middle school, in like sixth grade or seventh grade or whatever, an entire grade somehow decided that we would watch Pet Sematary for Halloween at school as long as we got our parents to be okay with it. And for the most part, our parents were okay with it.
It blows people's mind how much parents were okay with just watching rated R movies at school or whatever back in the day. Like, the parental oversight was just, you know, different.
Yeah, it really was. And so like, I don't remember being too scared of that. I do remember when I was super young watching RoboCop 2, and there's a scene in there that I guarantee you, if I watch it today, is going to be like the cheesiest thing ever in the world. I haven't seen RoboCop 2 since that it came out in movie theaters, But there's a scene in there where there's this big robot that was like the Ed 209, but not, it's like the new version of the Ed 209 that they show in RoboCop 2. And there's like a suspenseful scene where he comes in and starts blowing away a bunch of guys. And I was scared at that. I was really scared of that. Of course, I watched that movie now. I know that it's just going to be like cheesy and bad and terrible. So anyway, looking over.
I'm going to add one more thing to this because you reminded me of kind of that feeling of, oh, this is going to give me nightmares, even though it's not really anything now that I'm older. Kind of thing. And that was Wrath of Khan for me. I was like 7 or 8 years old.
Oh yeah. It's got some nightmare fuel in it.
That ear creature was just the freakiest, scariest thing I had ever experienced in my life. And it felt so real.
No doubt.
No doubt.
Over in the chat, we have Nick says Hereditary when I was 35. Yeah, I get you on that. Hereditary's got some very awful stuff in it. History Lover says Poltergeist, but I was still too young as a teenager when I saw The Exorcist. Flyboy says Wizard of Oz, 5 years old, and I had nightmares about the flying monkeys. Yeah, I get it. I totally get it. And Tatsuk Age Maru, House of a Thousand Corpses. It's also terrible, and I hate it. Yes, I agree with you on that. And yet you have a lot of Rob Zombie stands out there who continue to push that movie and The Devil's Rejects as great movies. Josh also says, I've been watching horror since about 5. I saw Predator in the theater. I was 8. Really don't have an answer for this, but I guess maybe I'd say one of the early Friday the 13th movies. And so there you go. Maybe room for one more. What movie did you love as a kid, but you haven't yet seen it as an adult, so you're not sure how you'll feel about it these days?
I think the one, because I like to revisit like my nostalgia movies from my childhood. I think they're a lot of fun, but I was thinking about this, and the one I really haven't revisited, even though I'm sure it's on Disney Plus in a long, long time, is Bedknobs and Broomsticks. And I just remember loving the magic of that movie, them going into the ocean, I think, and the mixed animation and in real life. And then I think there were the dancing or the marching empty suits of armor with the magic words Tricorus. I can't remember. Anyways, it just had a lot of magic in it and a lot of interesting things. I think it was Angela Lansbury. Like, I haven't watched this in like 30 years, at least.
I've never seen it.
So this was definitely on when I was a kid all the time. We had a VHS that had this on it. And that's probably the one that I haven't seen as an adult. And if I did watch it, I would be like, oh, this is not what I remember it being. But I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I frequently have talked about how back in the day HBO used to play when we first got HBO as a family, that was I think 1985, because I was seeing a bunch of 1984 movies. So like there's a ton of 1984 movies that I saw because of this. And one of them we used to watch all the time was The Last Starfighter, which was sort of took that thing about, you know, hey, you like video games, right? Well, here's how a guy who's good at video games would save the planet or whatever. And I remember loving it as a kid, but I have not seen it since probably the 80s at this point. And I think I have it on Blu-ray too, so I could rewatch it if I want to. But that's one that I'm not sure about, that if I watch today that I would like. Over in the chat, History Lover says, I haven't revisited the 1961 The Parent Trap since I was about 14. I loved that movie as a kid. James Kinder says, Bedknobs has some wonderful songs in it. Jets Met says, Oliver and Company. Nick says, I love the Robin Williams movie Jack. I loved it as a kid, but haven't seen it in probably 25 years, but everyone says it's bad, so I'm afraid. Nick, it is bad, yes. It's Francis Ford Coppola doing stuff that I do not understand. Probably just trying to make money is what he's trying to do with that movie. Castroff says The Night at the Museum movies. James says Bon Voyage, Charlie Brown for me. And then Josh says there was a dinosaur movie with William Catt called Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend. I wore that VHS out when I was 6 years old. Can't imagine how it would hold up now. And, I rewatch a lot of movies. Flyboy says, Maybe one of the old musicals wouldn't hold up now. Music Man. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the movie version of Music Man.
The old school.
But I did see the Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, you did.
Music Man. Yeah, I did.
The old school. Is it Robert Preston? I think was in the old school Music Man. I think holds up. I think that's I think he's incredible in that movie. Those songs are timeless. So yeah, I think Music Man holds up.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, it looks like we still have, boy, I think I did really well with that summary today because we have a lot of time here. One more question and then we will wrap it up. Let's see. What is the single most tense movie scene?
Okay, so recently it's probably the ranch scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for me.
Oh, that's a good one.
I thought that scene was incredibly tense, the way that it the entire scene, it's a masterwork in audience tension.
Yeah, think about what he's done there, because we're in an alternate universe in that movie, because you don't know what's going to happen to Brad Pitt when he's on there. He could, like, he's not a real, you know, he's not playing a real character. So, like, that whole thing could be the lead up to his murder and you don't know. And so, like, yeah, it's really well done. And of course, Tarantino, like, populated that whole scene with all these up and coming actors that are, yeah, all the Nepo babies and everything. But yeah, that's a great one. It's so good. I've got a couple.
I was going to say that's the recent one, but the all timer for me is the orchestra scene in the Man Who Knew Too Much. Hitchcock, of course, was the master, but that orchestra scene is just an incredible, again, masterwork of tension. So yeah.
I have a couple on mine. The Tom Cruise Mission Impossible CIA knock list heist is one of my favorites all time. It's one of the first times I saw a big budget blockbuster put me in that kind of I don't know what you want to call it, like a grip my seat type of thing, because it was one of those things where anything goes wrong, then he's caught and, you know, the whole mission is over, and you know he's going to get through it because he's Tom Cruise. But at the same time, it pulls the neat trick of you just going, oh no, it's, you know, he's falling too far, he's making too much noise, his sweat's going to drip on the floor, all this stuff is going to happen. It is such a great scene. And then there's another one in Sneakers where Robert Redford is walking across Ben Kingsley's office with the tape recorder that has the Yannick's box in it. And he has to sit. It's very similar to the Mission Impossible one, by the way, because he's got to move slowly and his temperature has to be just so, and he can't say anything. And it's one of those type of things where he's just, and they're like, you got to hurry, you got to hurry. He goes, the last thing that I can do is hurry.
That's a great choice.
Looking over at the chat, let's see, we have the detonation test in Oppenheimer, even though we all know what happened there. James says the bathtub scene in What Lies Beneath. Yeah, it's a good one. I haven't seen What Lies Beneath in forever. Nick says the first one that comes to mind was the opening of Inglourious Basterds with Christoph Waltz's character and Shoshana's dad. Great scene. Au revoir, Shoshana! Alan mentions the Mission Impossible Ethan Hunt hanging from the ceiling. Flyboy says killing Mellish, Adam Goldberg, and Saving Private Ryan. Yeah, that's a tense one for sure. Jetsmet says Children of Men, the walking out of the building scene, really everything after they come out of the tunnel. Yeah, Children of Men is just all tension. The whole movie is that, so yeah. Nick says the entire movie Society of the Snow, definitely, for sure. Tatsu says Fifth Element, the fire elemental part, held my breath to keep the lit match from going out.
Sure.
That's when you know a movie's got you when you're doing that. Josh says there's the bear attack in The Revenant. Jetsmet, Uncut Gems, yes, hell yes, at the end when he's going through that whole thing. Oh my God, so good. And then Snow One says the first 45 minutes of Alien. All right, that is going to do it for today. Next week's episode we'll be covering Gattaca. Can't wait to cut into that one again. Thank you, chat, for coming out and watching us today. That's going to do it for this episode. We will see you next time.
See you guys.
See ya. Bye. part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I mean, it's a much better week for me after cranking my head and losing a dog, somebody else's dog last week.
But yeah,
head's healing up fine. It's interesting after you have a head injury. The interesting thing is you're super aware of, am I foggy? Did I get a concussion? Like you're trying to use the thing that might be injured to decide if that thing is injured.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's this weird thing where it's like, would I even know? Or would I be too foggy to even know if I was foggy?
You kind of got to think of your brain as a big corporation, though, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's got a whole bunch of different departments that handle certain things.
Yes.
And there's the one department that's like, we're hurting. And then there's the other department that's sort of like, well, are you hurting enough? I don't know if that's the truth or not.
Right.
You know, like they have to go through a bureaucracy before you finally go, do I need to go to the hospital or is this just something going to go away or whatever? So,
You hear so many horror stories of people who are like, oh yeah, I just hit my head, I'll be fine. And then they die in their sleep. You know what I mean? Like it happens. So
That was the thing that was scary, really scary about, I don't know if you remember why they have nets up in hockey rinks now.
Mm.
Do you remember why?
No, I'm assuming now that a puck hit somebody in the head or something, or?
Yeah, it was a little girl, unfortunately, and her name was Brittany Cecil, I believe was her name. And she got hit in the head, and everybody kind of looked at her, and she's like, okay, this is, that sucked, you know, you got hit in the head with a puck, and you know, but you seem to be fine. She died the next day.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was the next day. I don't know if it may have been hours. It may have been a few more days after that. But the point is she died from it. And from that point forward, the NHL decided to put nets up.
Yeah.
Which is a thing. Also, baseball had been toying, like they were walking that razor's edge. I don't know. Actually, I think some people, there may have been some deaths, I'm not sure, but they've been doing that forever. But like, well, people like to get the souvenirs and everything. It's mm-hmm. like, well, yeah, but they don't like getting 115-mile-an-hour foul ball to the forehead.
Or a bat sometimes.
Yeah, the bat would sometimes happen, yeah. So, like, baseball was not exactly proactive, but it wasn't something like a big, like a death that happened that finally made them go, all right, because I think they realized there was enough injuries going on that, all right, we need to really do something about this.
You know, racing's had, you know, spectator deaths through the years.
Oh yeah.
The Ferrari that just came out had a reenactment of one of the worst ones that happened. And you just think, man, like, at what point do where do you draw that risk line? Right? So much of life is like that. So, like, I'm having those conversations. Like, where do I draw that risk line? What? And so I'm, like, Googling, like, the slightest of symptoms, what to pay attention for. And the truth of the matter was, like, I barely had a headache. So I didn't even, like, there wasn't any pressure, which is, you know, something they say to look for. Feeling nauseous. I didn't feel nauseous at all. So if I even had a concussion, it was a really, really mild one. But yeah, it just takes the slightest little brain bleed that you know, bleeds really slowly and doesn't have anywhere to go. But they say you should start feeling the pressure of that if that's something that's going on. But yeah, I just cranked my head against, I just tried to take out our deck with my forehead. That's all, you know, it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
I will tell you though, the head bleeds, man. Boy, does the head bleed. You get a cut on the head and it bleeds. Growing up, my brother was jumping on the bed. We shared a room, and I'm trying to get to sleep. He's jumping on the bed. He's like 6 years younger than I am, and I just hear like this, like thunk, And like he had cracked his head on the edge of the bed, like he had fallen and cracked his head. So I got up and he was like, you know, my face is wet. And so I got up and I turned on the light and it was like a horror movie.
Imagine it was.
His entire, you know, 4-5 year old face or whatever it was just covered in blood and just like a flap of skin is hanging off of his forehead.
Oh no.
And so yeah, there were definitely stitches involved in a trip to the emergency room that night. So
God, it's always like shocking. And like I'm not talking about the medical definition of shock, although that can happen too, but
yeah.
When you see parts of yourself that you shouldn't be seeing.
Right. Yes. Compound fractures, that kind of thing. Oh. Like, yeah.
Dude, that was the thing. Like, I think I was off of gnarly sports injuries after I witnessed Joe Theismann's sack, the Lawrence Taylor thing. Because they used to, they don't do this anymore because they realize how revolting it is, but they used to just show you every angle of somebody
getting
there.
Yeah, in slow motion and, yeah.
And the Joe Theismann thing, that happened when I was like 8 years old or something like that. And like, I don't know if it was that particular moment, but I definitely don't. Like anytime they say, oh, that dude just like that guy's knee just exploded on the field. Yeah, I don't want to have anything to do with that. I don't want to see it.
No, there's been a couple basketball ones too where they come down weird and for whatever reason they're what are the lower leg, like the fibula maybe and tibula or those bones? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think so.
They just break.
Yeah.
And then so the lower half of the leg just like there are two knees now.
It's a different direction.
It's
yeah.
So bad.
That is actually one that I did see and it was a replay. I didn't see it live, but that was that dude from I think it was Louisville. That fell down on his leg and I saw that one and that was one that was maybe one of the last ones I remember them just showing over and over again.
Yeah.
Like they finally came to their senses, but that one was gross, man. Mm-hmm. That one just like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. The body's not supposed to move like that. And somewhere internally, you know that and it freaks you out, you know, like there's just that like, ah, that's unnatural, you know?
Yeah. Kind of thing. Yeah.
The only time I've ever had anything like that personally is when I dislocated my pinky. I went to catch a football and it was going to be a low catch and it actually bounced off the ground and then up into my pinky. And so I pulled my hand back up and on the second knuckle, it just took a left turn.
It
was like going the wrong direction.
I had a similar injury actually when I was, I think it was sixth or seventh grade or something. I was playing basketball PE class, and a basketball landed on my pinky just so, and it was pointed out this far out when it was done.
Yep.
And I still have the stitches scars that are on the side over here from that thing.
Wow. Mine didn't break any skin or anything. It didn't need stitches. They pulled it back into place and it was really, really sore for a while. So.
Oh.
Yeah. It didn't break anything. It just dislocated.
It's funny how they can do that sometimes. I remember in baseball practice when my freshman year, we were practicing pickoffs and I was on second base and the pitcher, I was sitting there. I was like waiting for him to throw it back. And he just wasn't for some reason. I guess there was some instructions going on or whatever. And I was like, I'll just get back to second base for now until they get that settled or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I go back to second base and then I turn and the ball was sitting right there. And it knocked two teeth back all the way in the back of the roof of my mouth. And I was like, oh no, what are they going to do about this? And they just pushed them back in. Now, obviously, my teeth were messed up at that point. They had to take them. I think they ended. So many things have happened now that at first they shaved them off and just put caps on them, but then it became. Now I've just got these like ceramic teeth. That are there. But it's amazing how you can just pull something back together and say, "Well, it'll heal in a while."
Okay, so final story. It's so similar to yours. Again, involves my little brother. We were out playing catch. I was in college at this time, so I think he was, you know, he had to be a teenager. you know, probably 14, 15, something like that. And we were playing catch in the backyard and it was starting to get dark. And I was like, we should go inside. And he just, you know, he wanted to keep playing. So we kept playing. And I was like, okay, one more. And so we did that thing that you do where it's like, you know, oh, ground ball to second base. They're going home. Got to stop. And so like, I chuck the ball at him and he has his glove in front of his face. And the like porch light hit it weird or something, and he thought it went off to the other side, so he moved his glove to the other side, and it just full force hit him right in the mouth. Same thing as you, front two teeth just, you know, dislodged, you know, kind of thing. I want to say ironic, whether that's correct or not. Part of the story is one of the teeth I dislodged had been a tooth that he had been working on straightening for 5 years.
Of course it is.
It was a tooth he had since he was a kid that was like completely perpendicular to all his other teeth, like for whatever reason. Like, and so yeah, they had just finally were getting to the final stages of getting that straight, and I knocked it out of his head. So.
Oh, man. And you know, and that's not your fault, but you know that you sat there and just was going so bad, felt so bad about it and everything.
To this day, feel terrible about that, but
yeah, no doubt.
Stuff like that happens, but it's just, it's wild.